every parent of multiple children has grown used to the vehement cry from some room of the house, "Leave me alone! Would you leave me alone? Mom! Jenny keeps following me. Mom, Bobby keeps looking at me." We expect this from children about each other. It does not particularly arouse our curiosity, more like our prayers for deliverance. We have two that are waiting for the joys of multiple children. But we do not expect mature believers to complain in this manner in regard to God. We do not expect that they will tell God bluntly, "Stop looking at me. Leave me alone." This kind of talk demands investigation. Tonight we get more fully into the complaints that Job had against the Lord. And he is not at all hiding what he is doing. He comes right out and admits it here in verse 11. He believes that he has a right to complain. Is that ever true? I must say that as someone who complains from time to time, this stance of Job gets my attention. I don't know to what degree Job complained when life was going well, but I know that I complain in all circumstances. And what do the scriptures say about this? Specifically the New Testament here, a few verses to kind of set a framework here. 1 Corinthians 10:10 refers to those who were in the wilderness, and the people of Corinth are being told, "Nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer." Don't grumble, you in Corinth. Philippians 2:14. Do all things without grumbling or disputing. That kind of covers things. James 5:9. Do not complain, brethren, against one another, so that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door, and that's the capital J, judge, there. He's standing right at the door, so don't complain against one another. And then 1 Peter 4:9, be hospitable to one another without complaint. Well, I'm already convicted, and we're just getting going here in our introduction. But this is what Job has set himself to do. He is going to complain. And he does not care who knows about it. He's at death's door anyway. I think he's kind of got short-timer's attitude here. And he decides he might as well go out with guns blazing, getting everything out that he needs to. No meek submission to seeming injustice here before he leaves. So what are Job's grievances? We could explain them with various illustrations. You can maybe pick which one you like the most and remember it, or forget them all. Doesn't matter. But I came up with this phrase. Job has circumstantial claustrophobia. Circumstantial claustrophobia. God has put him in a very tight space in life. He has no freedom of movement, no choices. Everything is being dictated to him. He's being completely controlled. There is no possibility of escape. You just see him doing one of these mime things, you know, where he's feeling that all around him and can't get out of the box. Or we could say that Job feels like he's running some kind of spiritual marathon. Maybe a more athletic metaphor here for some. He probably felt himself to be more like a hamster on the wheel, you know, going round and round and round pell-mell, but not getting anywhere. Could he not have just 1 minute to catch his breath? Randy Stonehill sang many years ago, "Stop the world, I want to get off." And that is where Job is at this point. Another picture that came to my mind can be found in the book The Two Towers, part of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings series. So here we'll have literary for those who find that more compatible. In that, the hobbit Pippin foolishly looks into an orb that allows him to be seen by the archenemy of all free people, Sauron. And all that Pippin can see is this enormous, unblinking eye that probes the depths of his being. And he cannot escape that pitiless stare. Even after he's given a message and he falls back from the orb, he still feels the burden of that gaze as if it is always watching him. This is how Job is feeling about the presence of God in his life right now. All those truths about God that we would tend to hold most dear, the ones that I know Chris has pounded as best he could into the young brains full of mush that he's been dealing with, omnipresence, you know, omniscience, omnipotence, these truths about God that should be such a comfort to us, these are all turned around as negatives right now for Job. Has that ever been the case with you? Evidently, God can become someone who we view as an unwanted intrusion into our lives. How does this happen? Well, let's see what Job has against the Lord in these verses and to what degree we think his complaints are justifiable. Job begins in verse 12 with the charge that God confines him unnecessarily. Am I the sea or the sea monster that you set a guard over me? Job had been one to use his former freedom for well-doing. I mean, he's to some degree contrasting this with the way kind of things used to be. And we will find out as we go through Job, not that we're going to look at every verse in the series, but we're going to see that this was a man of charity, of good works. I mean, he wasn't just, you know, building a pile of gold and sitting on the top of it or something like that. He was a righteous man and gave of himself to others. So that was his way of using the life that he had before. That being true, why was he so restrained in his current circumstances? Why did God just seem to be holding him down? Have you ever seen yourself as a sea monster coming up out of the waves? Oh. Job is feeling that God must be seeing him as Godzilla, prone to arising from the depths to ravage cities. Is this what I am to you, God? Some say that Job is talking about a whale, others a crocodile, still others some kind of mythological beast. I tend to think that this was some sort of real, scary sea monster that probably is not around anymore. But Job is thinking that, man, he must be seen as extremely dangerous to others as public enemy number one. Why else would God have put him on such a short leash here? Job again has a correct view of God as the sovereign creator who oversees the activity of all that he has made. He's right on track with that. He knows that God is in charge over everything. Who is it that keeps the roaring seas within their respective coasts? Job knew that it was the one true God. Let's read about just that particular truth, the sea having a guard set over it. A few verses on that from the Old Testament. Later on in Job 38, 8 through 11, this is when the Lord is speaking, okay? And he says, "Or who enclosed the sea with doors when bursting forth it went out from the womb? When I made a cloud its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and I placed boundaries on it and set a bolt and doors. And I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther, and here shall your proud waves stop." Okay? The Lord is obviously saying, I'm the one who knows all about that, and there's a place for, you know, bringing that out to Job at that point. But here, Job is saying, I understand, God, that you are the one who does these things. I just don't understand why you feel like you've got to do it with me. Psalm 104, 5 through 9. He established, this is God, established the earth upon its foundation so that it will not totter forever and ever. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the sound of your thunder they hurried away. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place which you established for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass over so that they will not return to cover the earth. God has set boundaries. Okay? You know, you hear all the climate change stuff and, you know, the caps are going to melt and, you know, the water's going to all rush in and cover everything and so forth. And God is in charge of the boundaries. He will decide, you know, where the water meets the land and where it stops. Jeremiah 5:22. "Do you not fear me, declares the Lord? Do you not tremble in my presence? For I have placed the sand as a boundary for the sea, an eternal decree so it cannot cross over it. Though the waves toss, yet they cannot prevail. Though they roar, yet they cannot cross over it." So that's kind of comforting. But Job's right on, isn't he? He understands that God has set boundaries for his creation for the benefit of mankind. It's part of his common grace. We're all thankful for that. But Job wonders why such a limitation has been put on him. Why do I rate this same kind of limitation that you're putting upon the ocean waves? Would it really be so bad if he was able to be out and about, healthy and energetic, free to roam? Would that be so bad? Was he really going to run amok if God relented and gave him his life back? Did God really think that's what was going to happen? We all want God to guard us against harm, I'm sure. Probably pray for that. You know, protect us. You know, keep us within boundaries that make sure bad things don't get at us. We like that. And he does that whenever it is best for us. But what about when God sets a guard over us to keep us from doing what we want to do? Do we like that just as well? Does that bring us just as much joy and pray and elicit as much praise to God as when he's keeping harm from coming to us? But when he's keeping us from going out and perhaps getting into harm, when he keeps us in the same place with the same old problems, We've got some in our midst here who are going to a new place to go have new problems. But when you're in the same place with the same old problems and you feel like, you know, there's no getting out of that, there's not going to be any freedom from that, well, what then? How do we handle that? Well, the same God who protects us is the one who also limits us for our own good and His glory, obviously. God set a guard over the tree of life and sent Adam and Eve out of the garden. Well, that could be seen as a rather harsh move. Mean God punishing Adam and Eve and not letting them come and eat of the tree of life. But I think the more you ponder that, you realize that was the most loving thing that He could have done for us. Eat of that tree in a sinful state and you're done. So the first complaint is that God confines us rather than frees us. How legitimate was that? Next we have the charge that God frightens rather than comforts. God frightens rather than comforts, verses 13 through 15. If I say, my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you frighten me with dreams and terrify me by visions, so that my soul would choose suffocation, death, rather than my pains. Job is picking up on what was mentioned back in verse 4. He looks to his bed as a place of refuge, only to find that it brings greater anxiety than where he was during the day. I guess this means that sometimes Job went inside to try to sleep. I don't think the bed would be outside. I don't know. Maybe there was one. But it strikes me, whatever's going on, that Job is there looking really to the wrong place for encouragement. He's looking to his couch for comfort, an attempt that he perhaps shares with many believers today. He says that the couch will bear his complaint. You know, it will meet his needs to be helped in his troubles. But couches cannot bear that burden, no matter how many snacks are eaten on them. Or games are watched from their cushions, or naps are taken on them. Not that all of that isn't nice if God provides it, but that can't be what we look to see us through. What actually happens on his bed here is frightening. Job has terrifying dreams. Often serious illness does bring on bizarre nightmares. I mean, if you're having a fever, you're fighting things, you know, your mind can kind of go weird and create some pretty odd and terrifying things. But it's interesting that Job states that God gives him these dreams, these visions, whatever exactly they are. He's saying, you're giving these things to me. Does God give us all of our dreams? You know, I don't really know exactly how to answer that question. It's one that occurred to me that I'm telling you out loud, but I don't know exactly. I mean, obviously, ultimately God, you know, controls everything, and He could certainly keep us from having, you know, some kind of terrifying experience that he didn't wish us to have. No commentator spoke to this. I wondered if one would. No, nobody did talk to it, and I've never really heard that discussion. Does God intentionally bring us, you know, the dreams that we have each night? We know He is sovereign over certainly the things that we experience. It's possible that Job is not talking about what we would call normal dreams, even normal weird nightmarish type dreams, but only the kind of visions that are obviously from God, where you would say that was something that, you know, God clearly was revealing to me. We've already had an account of one of those, right? Courtesy of Eliphaz, and we talked about that and what exactly that was, and I tended to think it could be something that actually did happen, however misapplied it was, and we looked at the place later on in Job where Elihu will talk about how God does work this way, and that seemed to be an accepted experience in this time period, that God did actually speak, basically give revelation in this way. So perhaps he's only speaking of dreams that he knew that God had put into his mind, but there sure seemed to have been a lot of them. I mean, this wasn't, you know, one or two or three or something. This is something that seems to be just continually going on, making the night just a terrible experience. Whatever the case, Job is saying that God is responsible for the fear that he dealt with at night. And Job would rather die than keep facing these nightmares. He would just as soon suffocate, which I read is the usual end of those who have diseases such as what Job might have contracted. Okay, if what most people think, if you want to put it as far as a disease that we would still know about today that he actually contracted, that often suffocation is the way that you die from that range of diseases. And that's tough stuff here. I'd rather just go ahead and suffocate and die than deal with this anymore. So Job is still completely on board with God's sovereignty over the details of life, isn't he? No issue there, but this is hardly in line with thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Okay? That's not the way he's seeing what God is doing. Job is saying that God was preventing him from finding any kind of rest for his soul. Was that legitimate? The next complaint from Job is that he feels like he is under constant examination with, you know, no corresponding reward in sight. Verses 16 through 19. I waste away. I will not live forever. Leave me alone, for my days are but a breath. What is man that you magnify him and that you are concerned about him, that you examine him every morning and try him every moment? Will you never turn your gaze away from me, nor let me alone until I swallow my spittle? For Job, life is one long finals week with no vacation afterward. God is always observing, probing, testing. We would all probably say that we want God's attention, right? Oh, Lord, if I just, you know, felt like you were just, you know, completely involved in my life and guiding and moving me along. But Job is saying enough already with the attention. What more could I possibly have to prove to you? What more could there be that would come out of this? I think of Job as being like that rotten kid Sid in Toy Story, when he's told by Woody that he can see everything as his head spins around. So play nice. And he's running screaming, just like Sid. He doesn't want to be watched all the time. I was thinking also that he's hearing that Roz character in Monsters, Inc., you know, saying, always watching, always watching. And he can't handle it anymore. He's tired of being under the microscope. What, you know, what is it about me that I'm meriting just this full court press all the time? It's fascinating how our perspective can get turned around when we're in, you know, kind of dire straits as we see them, you know, very difficult circumstances, ones that we don't like, want to get out of. Do Job's words in verse 17 ring a bell for you? Just look at them just in themselves and just say, does that make you think of something? You know, David said virtually the same thing in Psalm 8. Why don't we look at that? Psalm 8. Reading verses 4 through 9. And you know the psalm and you know these words. What is man that you take thought of him? And the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than God, and you crown him with glory and majesty. You make him to rule over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea, whatever passes through the paths of the sea. See how both of these men started at the same place? What's man that you would be concerned about him? Who am I, Lord, that you would direct all of this attention to me? They start with this amazement at how the eternal God would give, you know, just so much attention to a mere man. But then they went from there to opposite poles. David marveled over the exalted place that God would give, you know, to we who are so frail and fleshly. But Job, now he's seeing only the downside of God's very particular concern with man. He sees this full court press of discipline and pressure to perform under impossible circumstances. But is verse 18 true? That you examine him every morning and try him every moment. Well, Job probably would not have said so a few, you know, weeks ago or however long we are down the road from when everything was wonderful. Certainly God is always working with us, isn't he? I mean, there is a definite truth there and one that we pray for, that we ask for. Lord, keep working with me. You know, don't leave me to wallow in this sin or, you know, whatever. Keep growing me. I need to mature and so forth. So we want that. And God has reasons for seasons of prosperity and seasons of great trial. He is always doing something, working on something with us. Can we be content with both of those, you know, ways in which God works in our lives, like Paul, right? He said, I can be content with plenty. I can be content in a situation where I have want and need. He'd learned the secret of that. Job has not at this point. He's still fumbling for the secret of how to be content and trust God and be at peace in all circumstances. Job was feeling only a hostile stare from God, not that face that would shine upon us that we have in that benediction. Job has no breathing space. He doesn't even have time to spit or swallow. Verse 19. Let me have a moment just to kind of swallow here. Apparently this is still a saying in Arabic today. According to the commentators, they still say this very thing, you know, can't I just have a moment to swallow here? Job's thinking, I'm on my last legs. Wasn't this constant scrutiny overkill? And Job was right in a way, wasn't he? The eyes of the universe were turned to the situation. He was under a cosmic microscope. But he didn't have a clue about that larger drama in which he was involved. God had chosen not to reveal everything that was going on here. But Job was making this all about himself and what he had a right to expect from God. That kind of selfishness will turn our praises for God's attention into complaints. Our last grievance of Job is that God punishes rather than pardons. He punishes rather than pardons. Verses 20 and 21. Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust, and you will seek me, but I will not be. Are we getting to the bottom of Job's bitterness here? Maybe so. I think we're getting into the crux of the matter. This is what continues to stick in Job's craw and will do so for chapter after chapter. This is really going to be the drum that he beats. Is all of this pressure and attention from God a response to sin? Is that what this is? Is this about his sin? Could Eliphaz be right in any way that this is about his sin? Job is, of course, being influenced by all of this accusation to think about the role of sin in this suffering. But as he reviewed his life, he just can't see it. Maybe he somehow missed it. Did I miss something about the way I was acting, that this really is right, what's happening to me? If that's the case, what's the charge? What is it? Just tell me what it is. And if there's something in my life that does need correction, Lord, did it warrant all of this devastation? I'm really not seeing that. Why can't God just pardon him and relent? What is so bad about him and what he perhaps did? This all seems so out of proportion. There was so much worse being done all around him that was not being punished in any way, it didn't seem. Starting with these unbearable friends. What is going on? We readily embrace the phrases of verse 21 from our position on this side of the cross. This sounds very New Testament, we could say. Jesus takes away the sins of the world. It's hard to know exactly what is in Job's mind as he thinks of the pardoning of his transgressions and the taking away of his iniquity. Sounds a lot like Isaiah chapter 6. Where that prophet's sin is taken away by the coal from the heavenly altar. That's a different verb there. The taken away there is different, but it seems to be kind of along those lines. Many different expressions are used in the Old Testament for what God does with a believer's sin, and we're not going to take time to explore all that. That can be a rich study. Nothing is said here about how Job believed God could do this. he evidently believed that this was possible, and certainly we know about his attention to the sacrificial, system, pre-Mosaic, of course. What's important is that Job did see God as one who is gracious to forgive sin. He certainly doesn't seem that this is, that it would have anything to do with his own actions. God must do this. He just did not understand why grace appeared to be withheld in this case, his case. Have I done something that terrible? I don't see it, God. I don't see it. If God did not relent in this punishment as Job saw it, then he was not long for this world. This last line is intriguing. Why would God be seeking Job? You're going to seek me. Job, but seeking for what? Is it, to further harass him as he sees it? You're going to come with another round of this stuff, but I'm going to be history? Or is he saying, if and when you do seek me to pardon me, I'll be gone. It'll be too late. Job might be saying that if God tarried in showing his grace, he's not going to be around to receive the pardon. Restoration would be impossible. So these are his complaints. And as we work our way to a conclusion here, we just continue to try to evaluate Job's words for what wisdom we can gain for our own lives. I'm someone, as I've said, who's inclined to give Job a break, considering all that he's dealing with and the limited knowledge that he does have. We learn from the example of the friend, certainly, to be a little bit cautious about, coming after Job for wrongdoing. But it seems clear that Job is allowing this limited perspective that he has of God to lead him into sinful complaining. I would term it that. I think that this is getting worse than chapter 3. We're moving steadily in kind of a wrong direction here. Job is seeing a relationship between his activities and God's activities where none needs to exist. Saying that there must be some kind of a relationship. What if God was glorifying himself in a way that had nothing to do with Job's sin or obedience? That was actually the truth, which we've been let in on. But Job cannot conceive of that possibility. His friends aren't helping him with that at all. Job's complaints are based on mistaken ideas about what God is doing in all of this. However he tries to figure this, God is not acting justly, but he's seeing God wrongly. When we do that, and then that leads us into despair, I think that is a sinful failing on our part. Complaining is a failure to submit to God's good purposes in our circumstances, is it not? That's why we're commanded to avoid it, because of what we're really doing when we complain. We complain because we can't see how this particular situation is a good thing, how it's a right thing, how it makes sense in the big picture. We complain because we think we're getting the short end of the stick. It's not right. But we're really saying that either God does not know what he's doing, or else he's intentionally doing us wrong. The fact is that God does know what he's doing, and he does have a good plan for our circumstances. We ought to be humble enough to realize that. and make it a part of our everyday thinking. God is doing things that we could never imagine. Just try to keep reminding yourself of that. God is doing wonderful things that we could never imagine. That was certainly the case with Job. He could only see the negatives of God's involvement in his life. His concerns will end up looking foolish, because he got so worked up about something that he had no business questioning. He will end up looking better than his friends, yes, but not all that much better. So how are you viewing God tonight? If you see him as a confiner, as frightening, as an examiner, as a punisher, well, you've got it half right. God is all of those things in their proper context. He is. He says so, makes no bones about it. But if that's all you're seeing, well, you're not going to want God around, that's for sure. If that's all that he is to you, you're going to want him to leave you alone. You will not want him watching you. Most men and women, of course, on this planet do not want any sense of the presence of God in their lives. He's only an enemy. But God also sets souls at liberty. He does comfort. He does exalt at the proper time. He does pardon. We see all of that in this book and throughout Scripture. So let's be open to all the aspects of the nature and the ways of God, and be in awe of them, of all of them. Praise him for all of the ways that he is. Let's be still and know that he is God. That will restrain our mouths from what is ignorant, what is sinfully complaining, and will rather bring joy to a troubled heart. Let's pray.